Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Kim Harrison. Kim, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very much better now that we have you on the phone. Wow, Kim, you know, it's been a long time that I've dreamed of having you on the program, and here you are.
Oh, no kidding. That always surprises me.
Now, why is that?
Well, I don't know. I think it's because what I write is very niche-oriented, and yet it appeals to a lot of people. It's just not really well-known. And then whenever I hear anybody who's not at a signing who says, I've read your book, or I want to read your book, it's like, really? You do?
Wow. Well, you know, I have a confession to make. I have not read all the books in this series, but this new one, Ever After, got me caught up. I think this is the third one that I've read. Let's just imagine now that we have listeners out there who have not read every book in your series and are not familiar with this world that you've created. What would you tell them about this world?
Well, I would say that it's an urban fantasy, which means that this is where we have fantastical creatures like vampires, werewolves, and witches who live in a modern-day setting. It's kind of like Bewitched, if you want to go way back. So my book is called Ever After, and the whole series focuses around a young 20-something witch who lives in Cincinnati, and she solves paranormal crimes. At least that's what she wants to do. Most of the time, she's on the run from people who want to do her in. She's saved the world a couple of times. But really, the whole series, it is not about saving the world. It's about Rachel, the main character, finding her place in the world, which is something that we all can identify with.
It's Wednesday as we're taping this, so I'm guessing you're in Austin.
Yes, I am.
Okay, I looked at your schedule. I know you're on a big book tour right now. We are in Southwest Ohio, and I'm wondering, why did you choose Cincinnati as the setting for these books?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, and it comes down to location, location, location. When I first developed the books, my editor said, you know, what if we put it in a real city? And I actually pulled out a map and drew lines on it within a certain latitude because I wanted to talk about the weather. And then I had to pick a city away from the coast because the magic is broken by salt water. So I had to take the coastal cities out. And then I looked at the population, and I'm not a big city girl, I'll admit it. I needed to write about a city that was big enough that we'd have public transportation, but small enough that we'd still have cars and whatnot. So I looked at everything, and I said, oh, it's got to be Cincinnati. And I told my editor, and I got this long silence on the phone. I don't think she was really happy with it at first, but Cincinnati is great. They've got underground tunnels. They've got a world-class zoo. They've got the Basilica there. It's amazing when I started doing the research how apropos it is to put a mystery with paranormal in Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, in my mind, is one of these decaying riverfront locations where you expect a vampire to be lurking around the corner. Nothing against Cincinnati, but there's something about these old river towns, another one's Dubuque, Iowa, where you just go, oh, wow, look at that funky building. You know there's some secrets there. You know there's an underground tunnel there and a secret compartment or whatever.
Yes. Yep, Cincinnati has kept a lot of its old architecture, and you would almost expect to see gargoyles on the roofs there. It's absolutely wonderful. Mm.
So this character that you've created, Rachel Morgan, she's got some difficulty with relationships, doesn't she? In this book, hasn't she had like four different relationships in the last 2 years, and they keep going wrong, don't they?
Oh, the way when you say it like that, it sounds horrible. I think we are at like year two or year three in Rachel's life since I've started, following her, writing her down. She's had one boyfriend die on her, saving her life, and then she's had another one go bad, and then she's had another one who got smart and left, actually. her current, well, she's really, currently she's unattached, but in this book, we see a longtime adversary, Trent Kalamak, who was the bad guy in book one, who is now starting to look more like a good guy in Rachel's eyes now that she has gotten to know him and learned why he's making these really ugly decisions that he's making in the past. And it's kind of hard to always be the good guy when you're trying to save your species from extinction, and she's starting to understand that and looking at him with new eyes. So it took me a lot of books to get to the point where I could take a bad guy and turn him into a good guy, but I had such a long span to do it in that it sounds really convincing at this point. And the readers, most of them are absolutely thrilled.
Because they like Trent?
They like Trent. They like the bad guy. And oh my gosh, now the bad guy isn't so bad anymore. That's even better.
What is it about bad guys that women like so much?
I don't know. Maybe it's the power that goes along with it. I really don't know.
Okay. I bet you know more than you're admitting. Kim Harrison joins us. Her book is Ever After. It's the latest installment in the Rachel Morgan series. Now, you mentioned earlier that she's a witch, but isn't it also really important that she's a demon? And isn't this very unusual to have a female demon? Aren't there only a couple of them?
Yes, there are. There was a war in the history of the books about 5,000 years ago where the demons and the elves kind of went at it, and both of them managed to decimate each other to the point where they're both hovering on extinction, and there is only one demon, female demon at this point, and she's nuts. She's kind of like the Wendy of the Lost Girls, but she's crazy. And it turns out that witches are actually stunted demons in my mythology. Mm-hmm. And Rachel has been genetically modified to survive being born with, to put it simply, enough demon genes to make her really a demon. And actually, Trent's father was the one who fixed it. So these two families have been intertwined for quite a long time, just kind of in the shadows. And Rachel has found out that she is basically a demon, and she's been working through it and trying to understand it because this is not who she wants to be. But she figures if you've got black and white witches, well, maybe you can have a good demon as well. So she's been making decisions, bigger decisions than she ever thought she'd have to. And eventually, I'm working toward Rachel's Happy Ever After. I've got two more books to go after this. And I haven't really put in stone if she's going to be in our reality or if she's going to be in the demon reality, or maybe she's going to find a way to make both of these things work together.
And the apparent villain in the story is someone named Kusox. Now, Kusox is a demon, but he's kind of a weird variety of demon, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Kusox is kind of the bastard son, if I may say so, of the demons. He was genetically engineered as they were trying to get around the curse that keeps them stuck in this alternate reality that really isn't very pleasant. And they thought that they could break the curse by creating a new child from magic and science. And he turned out not quite so well. In fact, they had to bury him in reality underneath the St. Louis Arch at one point. Mm-hmm. And Rachel kind of is instrumental in letting him go free in a previous book. So she kind of made her own mess that she's kind of trying to clean up now.
Okay.
But he has been since let go, and he's creating mischief. And, I never meant to say that mixing science and magic is a bad thing, but that's kind of how it turned out, because he's a nasty guy. I have a hard time writing truly evil psychopathic characters because I like my bad guys so much that they tend to turn into good guys. But this guy, Kusox, is so mean and so ugly and so deranged that he will be sticking bad to the end.
He is very icky, and he has someone who's associated with him who, I guess you just alluded to the fact that Rachel had made her own mess with Kusox. Well, she's also made a mess previously in a relationship, and now this has come back to haunt her with, would you call it Cusack's familiar?
Yes, Cusack's familiar. Demons use people as kind of like a slave or a familiar. And one of her old boyfriends turns out to, well, he hooks himself up with Cusack's, and they both come at Rachel together, I guess. And, oh, his name is Nick, and poor Nick. You know, nobody likes Nick, and I can understand why. He entered Rachel's life as a boyfriend, and it seemed to be going really well. As a writer, I don't plan too far into the future, and I thought, you know, this relationship might work. But then he started dabbling in magic a little bit more, and not necessarily the good stuff, and he really likes money more than he values friendship, and that kind of got in the way, and he slowly evolved into this slimy little worm that nobody really likes, but he's very smart and very clever, and he threw his lot in with Cusack's. So the two of them together are much worse than both of them apart. And, yeah, so yep, things circle back around, always, always. And I'm hoping he gets his comeuppance.
And the ever after, this is where the demons are forced to be, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, this is the alternate reality. They've kind of polluted it with their magic, and it used to be a paradise, and now it's not so nice at all. So they would love to get back to reality, and Rachel would like to see him there, but that's another story.
I think my favorite peripheral character, if you could call this character peripheral, is Al.
Mm-hmm.
I really like Al.
Yes, Al is another, I hate to say this, but he's another one of those bad guys that turned out to be good. We meet Al in the very first book, actually, and he's been contracted, shall we say, to kill Rachel off, which was the whole premise of book one. She did survive, obviously, and the two of these people, Rachel and Al, have slowly evolved a student-teacher relationship as Al, the demon, realized that Rachel was the first female demon born in, like, 5,000 years. They have a really odd relationship. It's not really subordinate, you know. I guess student-teacher is about the closest I can get because he obviously cares for her. He's teaching her magic and how to control her magic, but he's also got his own demons, shall we say, in his own past, and he sees Rachel as himself almost at a younger age, making the same mistakes that he was, and he's very bitter quite often, but he's also very dapper. He's very elegant, and he's really quite fun to watch, and watching him evolve from a bad guy into a good guy has been kind of fun. It seems like when Rachel's out, you know, saving the world, she either has to kill the bad guy or learn to understand him. And she tends to try to learn to understand them more. And then when that happens, they're not so bad. They're not scary anymore. So I keep taking my bad guys and turning them good. It's a double-edged sword, I guess.
Well, this is just a fascinating series and mythology that you're creating and sharing with your readers. And we have all these pivotal scenes where these amazing things happen, like the scene where Al and Rachel they have these rings that they put on, and rings are a big part of the story, different kinds of rings, and Al has this amazing ability to be able to just change what Rachel's wearing. Suddenly she's wearing all leather, you know.
Yes.
I can tell you're just having fun with this.
I am.
Yeah, and there's a scene at the Loveland Castle, which is a really bizarre thing in Loveland, Ohio. It was built by the Boy Scouts, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What a weird thing. I love that.
Yeah, I've actually gone to Loveland Castle a couple of times, and it struck me, I read a little bit of its history, and it struck me that it was really quite, I guess, poignant maybe, that we have this castle that was built by someone who believed in nobility and honor and you know, the things that the Boy Scouts believe, and it's standing there. And I don't want to say that it's crumbling to ruin, because it's not. It needs some repair here and there, but it's still there, and it's beautiful. It's like somebody's idea of Camelot. And I thought that was so strong and so powerful that I wanted to work it into the book. So, yeah, Rachel, in a previous book, actually made a ley line, which is a connection between reality and the demon world, right near the Leyland Castle. And so that allowed me to keep going back to that location in future books. But I do like Loveland Castle. It's, if you ever get the chance to go out there, I mean, it's really nice out there.
And you just mentioned ley lines, and this is really a pivotal part of the plot of this one. Rachel's ley line has been tampered with by Kusox. I don't want to give away too much, but I think my favorite parts are when she goes into the Ever After, and there's always this underlying romantic tension with her. She can't be distracted for long by all the weird things that she's dealing with. She'll return to something, or she'll stumble upon something, and at one point she's over there, and she runs into the other female demon's imprisoned partner, who is another one of her former romantic relationships.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. Rachel leaves chaos wherever she goes. Her collateral damage is very high. But in all fairness, Pierce, that's her old boyfriend, he sees himself as a demon killer, which kind of put him at odds when he met Rachel, because he didn't know she was a demon at that point. And then it's like, well, what do I do now? He got caught in some sticky business and became Newt, with the other female demon, became Newt's familiar. And yeah, so it's, I love bringing back old characters that we've seen before. I don't want to say recycling them, but I spend so much time developing their character that it seems, you know, it's hard for me to just let go and not see him again. So I took the opportunity to spend some more time with Pierce. Yep.
And your fans know that many books in this series seem to have titles inspired by Clint Eastwood movies. And,
yes.
And Clint Eastwood, he's kind of like a bad guy, isn't he? I mean, he's a good guy, but he's a bad guy.
Oh, especially in the Westerns?
Uh-huh.
Yes, yes. I'd kind of like to see Rachel grow into that kind of a character where she can come in out of the blue and solve the problem of the little town being bullied by someone. And her methods are not always legal, but they always have a good ring of justice to them. Mm. Yeah, that's kind of, I like that. I like that. But that's not the reason why I chose to mimic the Clint Eastwood titles. That was actually a marketing decision. Because it's recognizable, and I've had people come up to me and say, I picked it up because of the title. I never would have read this book, but I like Clint movies. So it worked in that way, but I do like Clint Eastwood movies. I think my favorite is Pale Rider.
Mm.
We're never really sure if he's an angel or if he's a bad guy or if he's the angel of death. I mean, I love that ambiguity.
I think my favorites are all the ones with the Hugo Montenegro music. With the soundtracks, those they call them spaghetti westerns,
mm-hmm.
like Fistful of Dollars for a Few Dollars More.
Yeah.
Just I love that music where he comes walking into the town and then you hear that.
Yep, me too.
They all start running away.
Mm-hmm. And then the guns go off and they sound like cannons.
Right. Kim Harrison joins us. Her new book is Ever After. I'm guessing that you write these pretty far in advance, and you mentioned that you have a couple more books left in the series. You've wrapped it up, or are you still messing around with those last couple of books?
Book number 12 is at the publisher, so I will have a rewrite. Hopefully I'll have a rewrite letter on my desk shortly after I get back from tour. If not, it's going to be soon coming. So that one still, I have the opportunity to make some major changes in it if I need to. Book 13, as you said, I do work very far ahead of my schedule. Book 15 isn't scheduled to come out till 2015, and I've already written the rough draft, but I will not give it to my editor for about a year because I gave it to her early once, and they ended up doing two titles in 1 year, and that was just too much for me. So I'm just going to hold on to that. But, yeah, I like working far ahead of my schedule because it lets me go back a book or two and put in some foreshadowing, and it makes me look like a better writer. Actually, no, I'm not necessarily a really good writer. I just work far ahead of my schedule so I can make myself look better.
Well, you're obviously a very hard-working writer. Kim Harrison joins us. Her new novel is Ever After. It's the latest book in the Hollows series, featuring Rachel Morgan, who is a very interesting character. And I'm wondering, I understand that Kim Harrison is a pen name that you use. How did you get into this? How did this happen to you? Did you grow up in a little town and read Anne Rice books?
Oh, I mean, you've read my biography.
No, I have no idea where you grew up or anything.
Actually, I grew up in a fairly small town in Michigan. We since moved away, and then we came back again. And I'm loving it. I'm a small town girl at heart, and that's where I like to be. I did not go to school to learn how to be a writer. I took science classes, and that's what I got my major in. Took the bare minimum that I needed to of English classes to graduate, but I read voraciously. And I read mostly science fiction and fantasy. Mm-hmm. And when you put those two genres together, you get urban fantasy. So I didn't know it at the time, but I was learning my craft. I was learning how to structure a story and how to pace it and how character development and all those little things that you really can't sit down and learn by the book. You just have to experience it.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing, I think, in my late 20s. And it was almost a whim, to be honest. But I fell in love with the craft, and I treated it like a part-time job, which, you know, it filled up my day. I had a young family at the time, and it was a break almost, my little escape. And I worked at trying to find publication for about 5 or 6 years until I managed to break into print, and that was with the Dawn Cook titles. Those are more traditional fantasy. I don't want to say they're like Tolkien because, you know, Tolkien is Tolkien.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they have a wider scope. They're slow for paced, and they deal with magic in a pre-industrial environment. And while I was still working on those, my agent said, you know, we need something else just in case this next series doesn't sell. So I developed Dead Witch Walking. It was a short story I wrote, even longer before I found print. And he shopped it around, and we found a buyer for it at HarperCollins. And that's why I had to take the pen name, to make a short story really long.
Mm-hmm.
It's always easier legally for the contracts to, when you move from one publisher to the next, to take a pen name.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what we did. My editor actually picked out my name.
I see. Ever After is the new book by Kim Harrison. She joins us on the program today. And this book has amazing stuff in it. And there's only one thing missing, and I'm very relieved that it's missing because it seems to be another popular thing in this genre, and that's zombies.
Oh, I don't understand why people are enjoying zombies. You know, I have nothing against them. I would just never write them personally. Cause how do you make a vampire sexy? He's dead.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you're on tour right now, and what's that like? Do you really enjoy meeting your fans?
Oh, it's fabulous. I love going on tour. I usually go out for about 2 weeks. And there is a regular circuit that I've been doing. I only go where my publisher sends me, and they know the stores that know how to put on events, mm-hmm. and that helps a lot. It's mostly independent stores, although I'm doing a couple of Barnes & Noble this year. The readers are fantastic. As a writer, you know, most of your time is spent alone with the characters in your head. And to actually get out and see that people are reading it and enjoying it, and you can see it in their eyes, and they're so excited when they come up to the table, and they're so happy to spend a few minutes with you. It really is, I don't want to say it's, you know, the summit, because that's not why writers write. You know, we don't write to become popular. We don't write to become famous or rich, because most of the time we're struggling to make ends meet. We're doing it because we love it, because we want to share what's in our hearts and in our minds and put our ideas on paper for other people to look at and enjoy. And so if, when you can get out and see it, it's absolutely wonderful. And I wouldn't do it if it wasn't fabulous, because I'm a raging introvert. Mm-hmm. And it's really hard to get me out from behind my desk, but seeing all those smiling faces and knowing they're enjoying my work, that makes it well worthwhile.
This new book has one of those covers that just kind of jumps off of the bookshelf. Do you have any input into these? How do they come up with them?
Oh, I have had some fabulous covers. This is actually one of my favorite, this one and Outlaw Demon Whales, and they're both kind of an orangey-red color. So maybe I'm showing a little of my favoritism there just because of the color. But the covers, I have a wonderful man named Larry who designs my hard covers. Mm-hmm. And he enjoys my work. I think it's because it's very rich in symbolism. And it's got, you know, I can have fire bolts and really cool things that they might not be able to work with all the time. And he's been designing my covers for quite a while. I do not technically have a say in them. If my editor will come to me and say, we're going to have a cover conference tomorrow, what would you like to see on the book? And we'll kind of go through some scenes that we might want to recreate or some clothes that Rachel is wearing that may translate well to the cover. And some type, I've actually gone back and rewritten to make a scene look like a cover. And I don't mind doing that at all, because Larry comes up with some beautiful covers. Mm-hmm. If there was something that came back to me that I really didn't like, they might change it just to keep me happy. But the thing is that now that the books have become so important to the publisher, the title, they will run past marketing and sales. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody has to approve it before, you know, we can go forward with it. And the cover's the same way. I used to have covers being redone because Walmart didn't want that, or, you know, something along those lines. You know, they wouldn't buy the book if it had that on the cover. And so it's funny how the covers actually get a lot of input from very many places, and the author technically has very little say about it, the cover or the title.
Well, on this one, she's got lightning bolts coming out of her hands.
Yes.
She looks like she's about ready to melt some trees.
Yep. Well, she's going to kick some butt.
Well, it's really been a treat having you on the program.
Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Our guest has been Kim Harrison. Her new novel is Ever After. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week when my guest will be Ann Leary. She has a new novel out. It's called The Good House. It's the story of a real estate agent who can't admit that she's got a little bit of a drinking problem. That's The Book Nook next week, right here on WYSL. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.